Okay. Sorry for a little bit of a late start with the AV issues. Please join me in welcoming Bill Reed, who's the Vice President and Product Management at Numera, which is a company here in Seattle, and he'll tell a little bit more about Numera as well. Before he was at Numera, he was at Microsoft for over 10 years, most recently Director of Product Management within Microsoft's Health Solutions Group. He was responsible for planning and strategy for a variety of their products, including Health Vault and Amalga, and Mayo Clinic Health Manager, which I actually didn't know about that Microsoft was involved in that. He's a founding member and past president of the Washington State Healthcare Executive Forum, and a fellow of the American College of Healthcare Executives. Thank you for coming today.
Thanks. So I'm assuming that you guys ask questions and interrupt and challenge stuff, because that's the nature of the seminar, right? So let's keep the ground rules the same. If we get way behind, I might say, hey, can we hold off, and I'll move through some slides and that sort of thing. But I definitely want this to be, hey, what's that? You know, explain that and kind of keep it more interactive. So when I first did the title for this, I talked about remote and social, and I'll talk about that as kind of key thing, organizing themes for the work that I do and my company. But I thought maybe the best thing to do is to kind of start that from this notion of, you know, well, why is this even an important topic? Why should we be even thinking about this whole area of telemedicine, remote monitoring, and social engagement of patients? Like, why even do that? Is that a big deal? You know, there's lots of other issues in healthcare that lots of other people deal with. You know, is this particularly important? So as I go through lots of research, and I spend a lot of my time pouring through lots of research and research studies and talking with researchers and talking with people doing studies, and we work with a number of customers who do lots of clinical trials, you know, a couple things start to pop out. One is this overwhelming burden of chronic disease. It is a significant issue in the country. And if you think about chronic disease being everything from as simple as a rise in obesity, the number of type 2 diabetics being diagnosed among adolescents at an all-time high. If you've ever seen the famous graphs from the CDC showing the weight gain over the United States over the last 20 years, it's remarkable if you put that in fast motion. It almost behaves like a viral epidemic. And if you took West Nile virus and the spread of West Nile and you looked at its spread relative to obesity, you'd see very similar kinds of viral effects in terms of disease, rate of disease spread. You can do that thing for lots of other issues. If you look at the World Health Organization's global stats on illness, a significant amount of global illness burden is actually chronic conditions. Hypertension and diabetes being two of the largest global burdens for healthcare today. So one is we've got this major epidemic. Right? This is care that goes on in a disease state that continues when a person is not in their doctor's office. Each year, close to 2 million new type 2 diabetics will be diagnosed. And the reason why lots of employers care about this is because most of them are going to be diagnosed while they still have 15 years of work life left before they're retired, officially retired, and yet people are retiring later. Right? Now, they might not have the pension liabilities that they used to have with some of the old, big old union contracts and that sort of thing, but regardless, they're still going to bear a cost here. And so you're seeing increasing numbers of employers concerned about what they're going to do for managing chronic disease among their populations. And they look at, hey, there's lots of efforts for wellness, and they're realizing that that's really having a very low payoff for them. They're much more interested in getting actually involved in some chronic disease care and some chronic disease management, and they're not, frankly, quite sure how they're going to do it. This coupled with this and these, there's a piling on effect of chronic conditions. So if you start looking at, many patients don't have a very simple condition, they have multiple levels of chronic conditions that simply accumulate over the course of a person's disease state. So while it might start with, I'm overweight, now I'm obese, now I'm hypertensive, I've got hyperlipidemia, oh, now I'm at pre-diabetic, now I'm a diabetic, now I've got heart disease, right? Next I have risk for stroke, just keeps going up and up, right? And we're seeing more and more comorbid chronic conditions that require more complex management. The other is that all of this, coupled with some of these other things, means access for care is really difficult. So if you start thinking about, you know, the issues that this school deals with, for example, family practice residency, the gerontology residency programs. Gerontology residencies are generally unfilled across this country. So we're not producing enough people who are going to care for older people, yet we have the oldest population we've ever had in the country. Go figure. The other challenge is that I went back and I was looking at various studies over the mean length of appointment times. And generally, they're unchanged. So I looked at a bunch of different studies. You know, people will say, well, I only get 6 minutes with my doctor. Well, it's actually about 15 to 17 minutes on average total care time. The problem is that if you've got this and that and this, that starts to not be an adequate amount of time. So now I've got to do what I wasn't doing before in the same amount of time. How do I do that? Right. And I get reimbursed potentially less than I used to get reimbursed, or I at least have an unfavorable reimbursement mix. And so clinicians are looking at this going, I don't know how I'm going to do this, so they start having access challenges. And then what that leads to is, coupled with these other things, where a significant number of Americans describe having a significant burden due to unaffordability of health care. So how can I do it less expensively? How can I get access to less expensive care, but not yet compromise in terms of the quality of the care that I'm receiving? So we have this challenge of how do I do that and maintain quality of care without compromising access. So a bunch of these, you know, you kind of look at it and you go, independently, I see lots of these threads, but when we start to put them together, you go, you know, kind of a bit of a train wreck of various forces coming together. You've got polypharmacy, you've got complex comorbidities, access issues, affordability issues, not a whole lot of care time, not a big supply of nurses and doctors to provide care for an ever-aging population. And so there's this quest for what are the alternatives, right? And there's lots of payment reform models and lots of other things that are out there. And we think there's a space for alternative delivery models. How can I do care delivery in a different way? And I think that increasingly you'll start to see those kinds of changes in how care has to be delivered simply because of a lot of these forces, whether it's the supply of sick patients, the demand of sick patients, the supply of physicians, et cetera. So this was a Deloitte Center for Health Solutions survey, health consumers. This is about 4 years old, so it's actually improved in some other later studies. But consumers generally want to have some sort of communication capability. Now, they don't really describe specifically what it is that they want, right? But, you know, I'd like things, generally, they're looking for a convenience factor. There's a major convenience factor. If you think about the typical process of going to a doctor's office, well, it may be a 15-minute appointment for the doctor. It's a multi-hour issue for a patient. And so if they look at that and they go, if I have to go through my, if I'm on Coumadin and I have to go to my doc's office to get a Coumadin check, I'm spending 2 hours to go get a check, which takes a fraction of minutes, at a copay and a financial burden that's going to be a minimum of a couple $100. Why would I do that, right? So they look at this and they say, hey, I want to try to alter the relationship or the way that I'm interacting electronically with my care providers. There was a number of different studies. You'll have copies of the slides with a lot of the references to these. But there's been a number of studies. And I think one of the challenges of, yes?
Yeah.
Mostly their primary care physician, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, like, they're not quite anchored off of to nurses, they're not anchored to pharmacists, though those start, or specialists even. And, well, I wouldn't say, depends on how you define slice the specialist. If, you know, if your primary provider of care is an endocrinologist because you've got advanced type 2 diabetes, that's who they're thinking. Who's going to give me my A1C results? In this case, I'll say one of the key challenges in this industry space is it is an early market, and there isn't a huge amount of kind of clinical and efficacy research that's been completed. The biggest study, and I'll share with you, that's out there, and it's really kind of served as the basis for a number of years, kind of the justification for the industry growing up around kind of remote monitoring, was a study that was done out of the VA. So the VA was actually able to enroll the single largest population. They still represent about 50% of all users of remote monitoring care. And they did a series of studies off of the VA population to kind of show efficacy of this. Recently, this year, late last year, and beginning of this calendar year, the UK rolled out a study of their populations. They were doing some telemetry or telemedicine research in the NHS, and they rolled out some evidence which seemed to be very closely aligned with what the VA was showing in their earlier studies. But there's been lots of kind of point studies of different activities that are out there really trying to look at this question of the efficacy of this. Is this a good, adequate substitute for various types of conditions? So we're involved right now in a number of studies with our customers. We have one study that's going on down at Palo Alto Medical Foundation in the Bay Area, which is a hypertension study using three devices, a weight scale, an activity meter like this, and a blood pressure cuff. They're all amp-based communicating devices. They are using an application that we built that's a gateway application that sits on an iPad or an iPhone or an iTouch. They're using it for doing wireless remote monitoring, the data going into their electronic medical record system, which is an Epic system. Small study, it's about 150 lives running over a 6 to 9 month period, purely to study kind of the efficacy of wireless remote monitoring for the care and management of hypertensive patients. It's going to fall into line with a bunch of these other kinds of studies that exist out there. And they tend to be about clinical efficacy and those sorts of things, right? One of the big gaps that I see out there is a giant gap in adoption, engagement, how do you get people to do stuff. Asking a person, if you look at the pharmacological research and you look at med adherence, right, there's a number of famous studies that have looked at med adherence over months. About 18 months, almost the entire type 2 diabetic population, regardless of level of copay, drops to about 50% adherence to pharmacological protocol after about 18 months. 50% are no longer taking their meds. It's diabetics. Big, relatively interesting study that's out there that I can find for you. So now you look at that and they go, okay, I'm not taking a pharmacological agent. It doesn't even matter for price. Why would I do long-term monitoring? That seems to even be more difficult potentially than taking a pill. Doesn't maybe have the side effects, but why would I keep doing something like that, right? So there's a lot of work, I think, that has to be done on engagement models. We'll talk about some of the things that we're doing, but I would say that there hasn't been a lot of kind of good research built in that space.
I'd like to ask you what thoughts you had about the names of the measurement observations that one might make in a home healthcare setting, and how that information might be exchanged between the home environment and the practice environment, so patients don't have to come in for a visit to get blood glucose go through.
I'll run through those in a bit more detail. But generally, right now we cover 7 classes of devices, from diabetes glucose monitors to PTINR. Peak flow meters, SpO2, weight. We're now starting to do some investigation on remote sleep monitoring, sleep apnea. They write to DISC. There's a huge amount of data. They tend to write to DISC.
You might comment on to what extent the names of those measurements and observations result from the LOINC, the SNOMED CT, and the IFCC, IMPAC, NBU, standard measurement observation names that is in the process of converging, but not many people seem to understand what that may mean and how it may lead to consistent cross-time changes and decision-making.
Yeah, I mean, we spend a fair amount of time looking at what is the data formats coming off, kind of the measurement types coming off the devices, trying to figure out how do we make sure that we can properly format it without altering the clinical content. We actually are, organizationally, what we do, and I'll describe that a little bit more, but organizationally what we do is we're a Class 2 medical device. We're an accessory to a medical device. And so we have to make sure that we don't alter the data, but yet can deliver the data in a format which is acceptable to the receiving EMR or source system. And the idea is ultimately that it's whatever standards are adopted or adopted into the software on the device itself and adopted similarly in the software that's on the in the electronic medical record system or system of record. And we're constantly having to kind of look at that.
That's a major challenge.
It is.
So curious, any comments you make on that?
So VHA, big study. They looked at lots of patients, the single largest study of its type, looking at numbers of patients, tens of thousands of enrolled, highly representative sample. I'll tell you, that's another underrepresented sample. There's very few studies involving women. Lots of men in lots of these studies. And again, mainly dominated because of the VA and the fact that the VA have mostly older men in their systems today. But their big thing here was they were trying to look at it, does it cause demand destruction? Does it destroy demand for more expensive services? That's the reference, the frame of reference that they were taking in their study. And they seem to show that. They seem to show, yes, when we do this, we can actually cause demand destruction. And recently, the VA made kind of some headlines 2 weeks ago where they eliminated copays for telemonitored visits. So if I do a video conference visit, I don't have a copay anymore. That was a big step for them to remove that because they're actually trying to provide an incentive for people to actually use that as a replacement for an in-clinic visit. But it's a video consult. You have to actually have live video with.
With something like that, how much of that really is patient-driven? I mean, it seems like it's more of a scheduling problem on the provider side to encourage something like that.
It mostly is, yeah. It's not most, and I would say that almost everything that's been done so far has not been patient-driven. Most of these are system-initiated activities, and when you look at the integrations that we do, like with an Epic EMR, those integrations with the Epic EMR, or typically, they show up as an order in the clinical system. So they see the patient, they want to put this patient on a measurement protocol, and they enter an order, and it's the order entry that triggers a registration action and enrollment in a program and the ongoing measurement. But it's in the form of a clinical order. And it's because that if it doesn't fit into that workflow, it typically doesn't happen. Once that happens, though, everything has to be patient follow-on activity, right? So it's one of these things where it's not patient-initiated or even wouldn't be necessarily tolerated as a patient-initiated action. But once it gets kicked off, you need the patients to drive it. This was an NHS report that came out. It was called the Whole System Demonstrator Program. And essentially, they were looking at the same sort of thing, how can I do remote monitoring. It was a smaller sample. They were really trying to look at, does it cause a reduction in mortality rates? They saw pretty substantial. I mean, this was like shockingly too good. So there's lots of other studies going to look at this because you're like, wow. There's another study recently that came out last week that seemed to indicate that perhaps maybe mortality is higher or was no different in a U.S.-based study. So this was the other thing. So A&E is their emergency department. So they were looking at reductions in visits to the emergency department. Generally, if anything that I can cause a preemptive action, so I trigger something that causes me to ask a question before I further decline and then result in an ambulance visit to the emergency room. And so they were really trying to look at that. And again, the NHS operates very much like the VHA. It's a capitated system. You want to create capacity, you have to reduce demand. And they're under a significant amount of financial pressure at the NHS to reduce costs. So in this country, lots of press around readmissions. So this is an active area where lots of healthcare organizations, hospitals, acute facilities like this one, around here, wherever I'm pointing, that way, care about, right? So there was this famous study, Jenks study, that came out that triggered this massive action to try to reduce readmissions, showing basically 1 in 5 chance if your Medicare patient admitted to the hospital, 1 in 5 chance you're going to be readmitted within 30 days. The federal government asked for a focus initially on CHF, AMI, and pneumonia as the three main discharges. They're in active baselining right now. If you have excessive admissions after this October, you're going to start facing a 1% incrementing penalty on your overall Medicare reimbursement for your patient population, which at first doesn't feel so painful, but once you hit about 3%, which is where they hit on one of their targets, 3% of your entire Medicare payment starts to hurt a hospital like this one or any hospital that has an excessive Medicare population. So lots of hospitals are rushing to figure out what can I do to avoid readmissions among those three classes of diagnosed discharges. So what do we do? So we're a company that has been in business for about a decade, though we moved our offices to downtown Seattle last summer. So we used to have an office in Silicon Valley. And so we still have a little office there, but today we're here. We also have a group of developers down in Orlando, Florida. They love Disney, so we can't get them out of there. No. We have a bunch of people who used to be involved working for NCR in their healthcare kiosk business, and they know healthcare devices. They work for our CTO. They all wanted to come and work for us since they sit down in Orlando, and we have a small sales office in the UK because we have a large UK customer that's a long-term care provider using our technology in their long-term care facilities. We're a company that exists in a portfolio, an investment portfolio that was started by Bill Rutter. So Dr. Bill Rutter was a guy who founded Chiron way back in the day and grew Chiron up until it went through a CB Geigy merger into what is today Novartis. And so he retired from there, a fairly wealthy man as a result of all of that. He's fascinated. He actually was a professor at the U for 3 years in his tenure. He spent a lot of time doing genetics research, and in order to do that, he would go get sea urchins from Friday Harbor and bring them back because they produce lots of ovum, and so he could do lots of reproductive studies on sea urchins. That's cool. He wanted to invest in companies, and he put together this portfolio called Synergenics to invest in companies involved in preventative healthcare. And so there's companies involved in all kinds of different things in life sciences, everything from how can I make, you know, protein production more straightforward and faster to us. we're a team that a bunch of us came out of Microsoft, who all worked together at Microsoft for a number of years, and in the healthcare side of things, and a bunch of people from actually device industry. So one of the reasons why I want to come back to this area is this is an area that has a lot of medical device instrumentation technology expertise, particularly in the Bothell corridor, a big spin out from what was coming off of Boeing and the UW predominantly. And so there's a huge pool of kind of industrial design, electronic engineering, and computer science in this area. So what we tend to do, and I'll kind of build this out. So this is kind of a, this grew out of a famous pyramid that essentially I think Kaiser maybe, some people say Kaiser came up with this. I think the Egyptians came up with it, but whatever. Maybe the Mayans. But the notion here is that a significant number of people kind of exist down here. Most of the population exists here at any point in time. This, as we saw earlier, is starting to widen in terms of chronic conditions, and then there's patients in this high complexity state that tend to be end-of-life care, or they tend to be episodic in and out. The costs, you know, you start thinking about the kinds of example conditions, huge amount of financial burden here, enormous amount of money that's spent for managing these conditions on an ongoing basis. This tends to be unmanaged, which then causes a pop-up here. Employers are trying to figure out what they do down here. And so they worry a lot about it, which really doesn't help that. But they do lots of programs you'll see lots of corporate programs, and most of them, if you ask them, do you think your wellness program is awesome? They will tell you, no, but I don't know what else I can do. So most will do corporate wellness. They have health fairs. They do different things. They have walking programs, challenges, all kinds of stuff. You'll see that generally they'll do stuff, but the way that I kind of conceive of this is like a financial option. Right? They're betting on, they're basically paying a small fee to reduce risk on an unknown risk base, sort of unknown population. But somewhere in there is going to be somebody who's going to pop up with a chronic condition. So kind of investing in that broadly. This is where they're spending more time, right? And they don't want to spend a lot of money, but they want to spend enough that it doesn't become a major expense for them overall organizationally. And then this is kind of classic hospital care, right? So the space that we tend to stay focused in has been in this space. We don't really get up into this. There are companies that do EICU work. So there's a company, VisiQ, they were bought by Philips. They do EICU, remote monitoring, telemetry in the home, a variety of things. Tend to be high acuity patients. They tend to be, you know, this is hospital bed in the home, DME, installed monitoring, you know, typically for a very short period of time at less expense than it costs to be in the hospital. Tend to be used to get you out a couple days earlier to prevent a readmission. Companies that, you know, those are tens of thousands of dollars for a system like that per patient. So you look at that and you go, you got to make sure that I'm flowing a lot of patients through leveraging that technology and that I have people on the other side who can actually use it skillfully. In this space, we've tended to kind of move this curve up now. If you asked me, you know, 6 months ago, yeah, we were all the way down here. And we still have customers. So we do programs like this for WebMD. So WebMD has their wellness programs, and we do monitoring using devices like that, and we pull data off of those devices for walking programs. And they do, you know, because typically what you'll hear down here is they just want, like, I want people to move. I just want them to move their bodies. And I don't care if they walk 10,000 steps, 8,000, I just want them to move. If they're not moving, I want them to move. In this space is really where we've found kind of the best spot for us to be, and it plays to some of the things that we do in terms of the device types that we connect to. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. One of the approaches that we took was we were going to focus on lots of different devices. So we built out a fairly large library of devices we can connect to. We have other companies in our space that have limited that down and basically strictly manufacture their own devices that communicate to their technologies in a known way. So kind of, they took an Apple-based approach. We took more of an Android-based approach. You know, we'll connect to lots of different things. The main reason that we did that was because most of the devices that people use are inexpensive, out there on the market, and they're covered by formularies today that insurance companies pay for, whether it's Medicare, Medicaid, or commercial payers. And so if you think about a glucometer, roughly runs about $30. It's a serial-based device. Right? It drives about $3,000 worth of strip costs a year. So the model is a razor blade model, and so the economics cause the device manufacturers to make cheap devices. They want them to communicate, but they don't want to spend a lot of money on them because that's not how they make money. They make money on the consumables. So there's lots of people who negotiate around the formularies of the strips, getting the strips on their formulary. And so they'll tell their patients, we cover Bayer Contour devices because we got the best price on Bayer strips. Or we cover J&J because we got the best price on LifeScan. And so we looked at that and said, we got to kind of deal with what people are actually buying. And we need to figure out how to connect to those devices. So we've tended to look at what's commercially dominant in the market and figure out how we can connect to it. The other is that we went through an FDA process. We bear a regulatory burden because we are actually a Class II medical device from the moment we grab the data to the moment we deliver that data. Why? Because people want to be able to bring that data into a clinical system, like an electronic medical record system, in order to make determinations about how to treat a patient. And we knew that if we didn't do that burden, we would cut ourselves out of that space. Some people we compete with actually don't do that, and they have other applications they make that don't integrate with the EMR, and so you have to go to that application because they won't allow the commingling of data.
Well, I think you kind of answered that question, but as far as what made you decide to do the class two device application, how many other people are actually doing that? How many other people see that the competitors that see that as an advantage?
I would say that people try to avoid it as much as humanly possible, right? It's a tax that you have to choose to bear competitively and set up, because basically here's what that means, right? When you say that you're a class two medical device, I don't know if anybody here's in pharma background or research, but essentially what they look for is, one, you've got an established quality system. So the way you develop software is subject to an established quality system, meaning you have standard operating procedures for how you do things. Typically, the guidance that is out there is typically, again, if you're a technologist, it's a waterfall type model. It's not an agile development model. There's a big push to try to get it more of an agile based model into the regulatory process, but frankly, today it's not. It's mostly a 4-phase, 5-phase review. You go through various gates. You complete, you know, essentially you have to do a market requirements document, a product requirements document. You have to do your plans and design reviews. You have everyone sign off. You have gates. You do a change order every time you move from. So if today, earlier today, I was approving a change order to move an application from our integration test environment to our production environment. And every single one of those moves, when I move a piece of software from another, I have to do a change order that goes through a multi-stage review and sign off, and we file all that, because at any point in time, the FDA can walk into our offices and say, okay, we're here to do a review. You're subject to an audit right now. And the company's gone through that in the past. And that's a kind of routine standard operating procedure. They go down through the list, and they randomly pull you, and off they go. We subject ourselves also to a voluntary BSI audit, because we do business in Europe. So they basically come in and look for ISO 13485 conformance. Okay, so you get familiar with ISO regulations, and you have to, you know, 27001 for your data centers, and, you know, so you walk through all of that, and you got to choose. You got to say, that makes sense competitively because customers are asking. For us, we did a relationship with Epic as an EMR company to do integrations, and we knew that we wanted to allow for data to be coming into the clinical record, and so it gives us position that allows them to be comfortable and their customers to be comfortable looking at that data. And because they want to look at it from a trending perspective and they want to monitor patients in that single clinical repository, they don't want to go to a separate system, typically. We run as a cloud-based service. So we host, people consume the services, you don't have to install it on your hardware. We remotely monitor and manage that service. There's a small client. We have a couple different gateways, and I'll talk through those, but we have the most that we install is a small client piece of software on a PC if you choose to go that gateway direction. Otherwise, no software required for local install. We also do take care of consumer fulfillment. A lot of our customers, we're in the process of actually building this out. Customers asked us, we're not in the device business, we're in the healthcare business, you get the devices in the hands of people. So we actually have a relationship with a warehousing vendor who does all of the custom kitting and puts all the stuff together, puts all the devices in a box and ships it to a person's home. There's companies that are emerging in this space that do full service wrappers around technology, all the services, in-home installation, patient education, the whole deal, fully specializing in just this part of the market. And we'll talk about some of the other things. So, again, mainly focusing on the chronic patients. We connect to all these common devices. You can go into Walgreens or, you know, Bartels, and most of these you can find. Some of the devices actually require a physician prescription. But for the most part, these are commonly accessible devices. Just go buy them. Now, many of these devices have a little, like on this one, there's a little USB port on the top. On this one, there's a little barrel serial adapter, little serial port sitting down here. In here, there's a serial adapter on the back. Most of these devices, they're designed to be inexpensive. The most inexpensive communication protocol to date has been serial-based communication. So most of these devices communicate over serial, which means that what we've had to be in the business of is building serial adapters for these devices, building cables. So we manufacture cables like this with little adapter tips. We make 13 different tips for different devices. We actually did adapter work where we actually can identify the device by resistors that we put in the adapter tips. So the resistor value tells us what device is plugged into it, and that comes across as metadata for us with the USB port that plugs in either into a hub or into the PC. And that's what we have to deal with, right? So there's increasingly, so most glucometers in the market are serial-based glucometers. The big innovation that's happening right now is USB. Huge. USB devices are huge now. And Bear Contour USB is the fastest adopted glucometer on the market today because it's a little bit easier. It's a convenience play.
So could you clarify what the population is? It was also the previous slide.
Yeah. So. So the typical profile of this are patients who have at least a single chronic condition. Most happen to be in a demographic that's about 55 through 75. Some of the older patients are into their 80s. So you're talking about one of the challenges being I have visual impairments from my disease. I have impairments due to my age. I have issues associated with using technology that everyone else assumes, especially engineers sitting in an office in Seattle, assume that people can deal with. Right? There's high usability issues in this population.
So when you say the population, is it American or is it the...
We're in America. We're in the U.S. and UK right now. And that's...
So 95% of the population in the UK and America have...
Yeah, only a small fraction are doing actual full acute care. So if you think about, there's only a small fraction of patients who are actually in a hospital every year. Right? Most people are either trying to do prevention and wellness, they're post-discharge, or they're dealing with a chronic condition of some type. Right? Most of us are mostly well. So then what we do is we put a gateway around this. So we have two different ways of basically collecting data. Design and manufacture a hub. So it's a really simple device that communicates over analog and digital lines. Also has the ability to do GSM, so you can put a cell stick in it, or over Wi-Fi with a dongle. Two connectors here, two in the back for USB, so I can take these kinds of cables and plug them in. And small screen that helps guide me through what I need to do, usually about two steps, upload. We're looking at what can we do from a survey perspective, because we're being asked, can I do qualitative survey on here, very short stuff, just a simple, even a question like, I feel better today than I did yesterday, or how do you feel today, 1 to 5. I mean, very simple qualitative information is typically what people are looking for. This device communicates back to our cloud. Why do we do this? It's an appliance, doesn't require a computer. I plug in, push, gone. Try to make it as simple as we can in terms of just that process. At some point you'll hear, you go to conferences, you'll hear about all kinds of magic devices that are going to communicate wirelessly. And someday, nobody pays for them today. The problem is, they're not on anybody's formulary. No P&T committees and big payers have paid for them and cleared them. And consumers are not going to pay $150 for a Bluetooth glucometer plus the $50 data plan every month plus the strips that aren't on their formulary. Walt Mossberg might think that's a great solution. It will be 10 years from now. will be, that's how it will happen. But at data rates today and usability, it's difficult, right? So typically not, we kind of have to go where people are, and most, again, most devices that are out there, serial-based communication devices. We do a software gateway for the PC. Some people say, well, I got a PC, let me use my PC. So we took the software gateway and we make it available on the PC. We also make it available on iOS, so I can use that gateway for iOS. And iOS, we tend to do a little bit limited set. So we do Ant Plus with iOS, so we're limited to a smaller set of devices than we do in others. So Ant Plus is what Garmin basically backs. If you have a Garmin fitness watch, Garmin's basically the main funder of the Ant Plus movement. It's a broadcast medium. It's a broadcast signal. It's promiscuous, and whoever picks it up and contacts it gets that signal and upload. We do the turnkey fulfillment and stuff. We do smart data support, and we link to lots of different systems on the back end. I'm going to talk a bit about our social. These are the different categories that we cover. So we try to make sure that in a complex chronic disease, it requires actually lots of different devices to get a fuller picture. And so part of the reason why we connect to lots of devices is so that we can have a fuller picture. If all I want is, I could just take a glucose value. But there's some studies out there that seem to indicate that actually blood pressure may be a better indicator of diabetic management than glucose.
So what about the more modern devices?
Yeah, so in the wireless devices, let's take a Withings scale or a Fitbit, right? So those do server-side connections. So we have to connect to them on a server call off of our data services to go get that data. We can't, they won't connect to our hub. They won't connect to our local software. Don't need to, because they go up through their data services. So we just have to negotiate to get that data from those providers. And typically you sign a license agreement to get access to their APIs and you get the data. This is our health port. It's pretty fairly simple. We got it in white. It's battery powered. It's AC adapter powered. I'll quickly introduce a couple things. We actually just announced the purchase of the assets of a company called Blue Libris. Blue Libris has developed a device. It's not in the market yet. We're going to be bringing it into the market, but it's a device that does fall detection and essentially think of it as PERS. And we felt like adding it to our portfolio would fill out a couple gaps for us. So much of the chronic population is also is a frailer population, so we wanted to have, how can we have another device in the mix? The other thing about this device is that it is a Bluetooth connecting gateway, so we can Bluetooth connect to it, so that's how we'll do, as we get into Bluetooth protocols, we'll connect. The other is it's essentially a GSM device. So it has a phone. There's a data plan built into it, and it's a phone. And it does algorithmic fall detection. We felt that it was an opportunity for us to kind of get into a market that tends to be a fairly large market and a fairly established market. So while we're waiting for a large part of the chronic disease remote monitoring market to mature, we're in a mature market, so it gives us a bit of diversity in terms of investments. But huge number of falls. Now, there's an interesting research problem in here, which is when you're developing an algorithm, so we essentially are using machine learning to train an algorithm, to develop an algorithm, you collect a whole bunch of fall data. Question is, you got an ethical dilemma. How do you get fall data? Before you launch the product. You can't get a bunch of people who are 87 years old with severe osteoporosis and you know to basically fall. Even consented, it's probably not something that you want to do, right? So you end up having to build an algorithm off of models doing falls, you know, stunt people and actors, and then you have to broaden your false positive detection. So you have to, until you gather enough actual data to rebuild the model and retrain the model, you have to alter your false positives. So you have to widen the hoop. And so we're going to end up responding to more false positives on falls than we eventually would like to. But but we're going to have to tighten that algorithm down over time once we actually replace it with real data. It's a device. It's about the size of a key fob. And it does GPS tracking, so when you fall, it knows where you fell. A lot of the PERS systems that exist today are homebound, so you got to be in the home. Well, my 90-year-old grandmother goes to the store and goes to doctor's offices. She fell in the store. She falls going in and out of the house, going to because she tries to shovel her yard. She can't see. She tries to go do that.
What does PERS stand for?
PERS is personal emergency response. So it's the I've fallen and I can't get up, which is kind of funny, right? You think, hey, that's kind of a funny line. I remember it. I've fallen, I can't get up. Everyone knows it. They kind of do the head nod, right? Most people that fall, they're out. They fell because they stroked. They hit their head on the way down. They're unconscious. They passed out. They tripped and they can't get to their device. That's who you really very often care about. Let me talk about social and then we've got to wrap up. So one of the things that we wanted to do is we spent some time building out and looking at behavior change, because when you introduce a technology for doing monitoring, you have this question of how do I measure people, or how do I provide an incentive for people to do remote monitoring over a long period of time. And so we built an application called Numera Social, which uses Facebook as both an application delivery platform, as well as using the social graph of Facebook to allow people to more easily include their friends into their social support networks for behavior change and supporting them. So we built out this system as a technology. It's built around this notion of setting goals, having plans, and having challenges around those plans. And uses, again, the social graph, allowing you to invite people in and interact around that particular set of technologies. And it was really built on, we did a bunch of work. Heidi Halverson was an advisor to us in terms of how do we think about this behavior modification process, and what would that model look like, and we've been spending time building that in. Some people will say, well, yeah, but what about, you know, your demographics? Well, there's some interesting things we've learned. One, if you want to reach women, you're more likely going to reach them on Facebook than men these days. If you want to reach older people, you can reach them on Facebook because they're getting on because of their grandchildren, because they want to, that's how photo distribution is happening from their grandkids. So people are setting up Facebook accounts. But high growth rates, not big numbers, but high growth rates, right? And so we use that. Now, some people will say to us, well, what about privacy, right? So we built this so that you can actually unlock it from the Chrome of Facebook and put it as an application in any other site. Still uses Facebook's social graph capabilities, but the site itself, we host. It's not hosted on Facebook. Facebook doesn't get your info. You could share with Facebook if you choose to through an API, but all the rest of that data is all here. And you can manage your stuff. It's on the Chrome of Facebook. We also said, hey, there's a lot of smartphone users, so we have a companion application that we built for iOS. Go download it, and go sign up for this new social. Love for you to give me feedback, send me info on it. There's some usability stuff we know about, so I'd be curious what you see and what you find and how you react to it. built it iOS so that you can have something that's mobile, carry with you. We also made it so that you can alter things. So these plans, one of the things that we did for the American Diabetes Association, actually, was we created a unique instance for the ADA of Puget Sound in support of their Tour to Cure efforts that are going on. And if you're not going to ride in the Tour to Cure, it's in 3 weeks. You can go sign up and go on a great bike ride over on the east side for the ADA. but we built with their content a whole series of plans that are, hey, I've never ridden a century. How am I going to organize that? Well, if you're going to plan on riding a century and you've never ridden one, you haven't started training, don't do it now. Pick the shorter distance. But we put that content together, and you can go and use that to organize the effort, right? And so it has lots of other things. You can see your friends, and you can choose goals, and all of that we can modify. So from that perspective, it has platform-like characteristics because of the modification capabilities. But we did this for ADA for that. And again, use lots of their content to build out the plans. You can sign up for a plan and organize how you progress through that. So here's me. I had a big spike with my steps, and then I stopped wearing my pedometer as regularly. So at that, I'm going to wrap it. And I can take any questions afterwards, but I know you guys probably have to run. Some people have to run off to other things. So,
okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks.
One thing I was curious about with the bringing the data back into the clinic space with like Epic or something, what does that actually look like for the provider? I mean, how are it seems like the amount of data that can be accumulated by just one patient is pretty significant. So I'm just wondering how they are.
Looks
able
like
to,
crap.
Yeah.
It does. So one of the.
Are you guys designing any of that, or is that part of the.
We can't design Epic, right? The
yeah.
problem is that you have to get the customers to tell Epic how they want to see it. So today it comes back into a flow sheet, and they see this, it's called patient entered flow sheet, PEF module. And you look at it, and you go, it's tabular, and it doesn't do exception reporting. And so providers look at it and go, I got to look at it, but you got to give me some more. Now, on the MyChart views, it's graphical, a summary value, put ranges around it and all that. So for the consumer, it's a much more pleasant interaction. But for a provider today, until Epic does some modification, it's tough, right? So now they're saying, well, maybe you guys, could you guys make something that you could we could integrate with our Epic system? And we're like, you know, if we can show Epic some things and we can give them design comps and things to help them look at that, but you probably need to both kind of go there. Because at the same time, they also don't want another system. So the clinical users have been very clear. I want one system of record. I want to go just to that system. I don't want... Part of the plague of this business has been everyone creates a separate system, either because of the FDA issues or because they didn't know how to do the integration. And nobody goes, you know, it becomes a specialty product, not a mainstream clinical product.
So just following up on that, given how the important
earlier,
can they set up alerts on our range?
Thank you.